The headlines: Finland and Sweden formally apply to join NATO. Moscow has already warned the move will have far-reaching consequences. A Pentagon probe concludes that a 2019 airstrike in Syria did not violate the law of war despite killing civilians. And also in our headlines, North Korea's leader blames official negligence as the number of COVID infections hits 1.7 million. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Finland and Sweden formally submit their request to join the NATO alliance, a move that is likely to draw a response from Russia. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has welcomed the bids for membership, describing it as a historic moment. The decisions triggered by Russia's military operation in Ukraine have earlier drawn Moscow's reaction. Russia has warned Finland that the decision would seriously damage bilateral ties and security in northern Europe. Moscow has also warned of deployment of nuclear weapons and hypersonic missiles. Meanwhile, the bids for membership in the US-led alliance are drawing Turkey's opposition, with Ankara threatening to block their requests. The Turkish president has accused both countries of harboring terrorist organizations. Well, there's no way of knowing how badly the conflict in Ukraine might damage the European Union's economy, experts tell an international conference in Brussels. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Rising electricity, gas, oil, petrol and food prices are drastically pushing the standard of living down for millions of citizens across the 27-nation EU. The European Commission's flagship annual conference focusing on the economy has been told things could get much worse.
In addition to the fact that the war could escalate, sanctions and counter-sanctions could create further problems, there is also the fact that in China, growth is slowing.
The Brussels Economic Forum 2022 also heard that financial pressures, mainly resulting from the conflict in Ukraine, are disproportionately impacting young adults in precarious jobs.
We're picking up incredible increases and disconcerting increases in anxiety, stress, depression, burnouts.
Some analysts suggest untold misery is being piled on citizens because the West purposely ignored Russia's legitimate security concerns. We have been seeking opinions on the current economic pressures.
A person who is employed, he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our savings will go down.
It will go until the point where people understand, okay, this is the peak, we cannot do anymore, and then let's see what's happened. I don't know.
Not only the energy, but the prices of food, the prices of transport. So everything is much more higher.
Driving the EU's foreign policy, critics say Washington has put the bloc in an unwinnable situation. There was no mention of that by key speakers at the Brussels conference.
Thanks to our unity, we have seen that swift and sweeping sanctions can have enormous force.
Enormous force for who? Russia's currency, the ruble, is doing very well, and the Federation is benefiting from rising energy prices. Experts warn of catastrophe if the Kremlin decides to cut off its gas supplies to the EU. As one contributor at the Brussels Economic Forum put it, there is no economy without energy. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
On this edition of the News Review, the Pentagon says an investigation into a 2019 strike by American forces in Syria that reportedly killed many civilians has found no policy violations or, quote, wanton negligence. The probe focused on an airstrike by U.S. forces on an alleged Daesh bastion in Syria. The investigation was launched last year after the New York Times reported the U.S. military had covered up dozens of civilian deaths. The Times report said 70 people, many of whom women and children, had been killed, adding it could amount to a war crime. The U.S. Army investigation, however, rejects that conclusion. The Pentagon report claims that, quote, administrative deficiencies delayed the U.S. military reporting on the strike, giving the impression that it was being covered up. The Pentagon probe claims no, quote, wanton disregard caused civilian casualties in the strike. Plus, it puts the number of civilian fatalities at only 4. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Mohammed Amiouz, joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus, and also Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Mr. Tim Anderson, is joining us from Sydney. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mohammed in Damascus. First of all, what has been the response to this investigation by the Pentagon?
Yes, first of all, we have to point out that it doesn't make sense, according to many analysts, to believe that there is a credible investigation in which the same side that carried out the strike carries out such a probe or investigation. Second, it's very important also to say that the U.S. media itself reported that there was a large number of civilians killed at that time due to this airstrike, this particular airstrike in Syria at that time. According to U.S. media, there was a secret ground U.S. unit that called in the strike, claiming that it was in self-defense and that there was a U.S. reconnaissance drone over that area, which showed in high definition images of women and children mostly. Yet the airstrike happened over there, and when more and more civilians those survivors of that attack tried to escape away, another airstrike by a U.S. Fighter jet was carried out over there, killing tens of civilians. This is according to U.S. Media outlets themselves. The Syrian government always made it clear, officials in their statements, that all of the airstrikes carried out by the U.S. and the United States in general are against Syria's sovereignty, without Syria's approval, without a U.N. Mandate. Thus, it is illegal. And all of those airstrikes killed civilians in Syria. Those strikes undermined the sovereignty of Syria and destroyed the infrastructure, which means that also eventually those strikes, which are intended, according to the United States, to defeat Daesh in Syria, did not defeat Daesh for years. What they did was only kill the civilians.
Right. Tim Anderson, I'd like to get your thoughts on this investigation, the circumstances surrounding the strike as well. There are some discrepancies with the number of civilian fatalities. This report, which, as Mohammed, our correspondent in Damascus, also just mentioned, which is a very questionable report, only puts the number of civilian fatalities at 4.
Yes, well, I think there's a problem in looking at this story totally from the U.S. point of view. In the U.S., the story is that the journalists of the New York Times had uncovered the massacre of dozens of civilians at Al-Baghouz, which is very near the border of Syria and Iraq. But they adopted the Pentagon's backstory, which was that the bombing was carried out as a part of an attack on ISIS or Daesh. Now, the problem is that there was no real U.S. attack on Daesh or war on Daesh at that time. And in that particular part of Syria, you may recall that General Soleimani had declared the defeat of Daesh in all the major towns and cities of the region in November 2017. That's more than a year before the bombing at Baghouz. The situation at Al-Baghouz near the border there in early 2019 was one of the Syrian army and the U.S. with its embedded proxies, the SDF, there. And the battle that was going on at that time was the U.S. trying to move the Syrian army out and let its proxies, the SDF, come in.
Stay with us, gentlemen, as we're going to take a look at some online reactions to this development. Airmate writes, in Syria, the U.S. massacred around 70 civilians and covered it up. After New York Times exposed it, Pentagon ordered a probe, but this probe just continues the cover-up. While faulting the initial review, this new probe claims that the victims were mostly combatants, which is a flat-out lie. Fast writes, when a criminal's mother is asked to investigate a murder committed by her son, such a result is forthcoming. Next user, Summer Chill, writes, killing dozens of civilians at one strike is no war crime, neither is concealing it for 2 years. How come the USA is in the sole privilege to define war crime? And Varun writes, we kill ourselves, we review ourselves, we punish ourselves, kinda. The greatest perpetrator of human rights, the greatest invader in the current times, And if others don't like us, we put sanctions on them. Let's get back to our guest, Tim Anderson. One of the online responses there that we saw, it stated that it's basically the United States that gives itself the liberty to define what a war crime is. Dozens of civilians have been killed. They covered it up for a number of years. And, of course, this isn't the first time that this has happened. And Syria is not the first country where such attacks have taken place as well.
That's true. There was a doctrine which came out into the open during the war that they carried out against Vietnam called plausible deniability. That is to say, they would keep denying their involvement in crimes as long as they possibly could. And that led up to the exposure of a number of serious massacres, in particular the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. Now, in this case, I was in Deir ez-Zor in late 2017 to investigate the cover-up of another massacre by US Air Force, and that was the massacre of 120 Syrian soldiers. They claimed they were attacking Daesh there. The evidence was overwhelming. They carried out a crime, slaughtered 120 Syrian soldiers, and blamed it on an attack on, a mistaken attack on Daesh. So they've been doing this for a very long time.
And Mohammed, the issue of having a credible investigation, a credible probe into this, an independent probe, what is the likeliness that we will see a probe in that regard, in that matter, or will this just be pushed under the rug like it has so many times before by the U.S.?
Yes, unfortunately, no one believes that any kind of an independent or credible investigation will be carried out with regards to this particular attack, because look at the events that happened inside Syria, the developments, for example, and all the airstrikes, and not just the U.S. airstrikes, but also the Israeli ones that have killed for years civilians inside Syria. And despite all of the letters that the Syrian government sends the United Nations in order for it to take and shoulder its responsibility in preserving international peace and security and stop such attacks, nothing actually has been happened. No action was taken whatsoever, not even sometimes not even a condemnation of such attacks, despite the fact that those attacks are illegal and undermine Syria's security and stability, despite the fact that the United States US-led coalition is carrying out such attacks illegally, and there is no accuracy in its information and intelligence before it carries out such attacks. Despite all of the images and videos that we've seen of the results of such attacks, the impact on civilians and their houses, public and private institutions, despite the images that we saw of Al-Raqqa, for example, also the destruction as a result of such airstrikes, nothing has happened with regards to any kind of investigation or any kind of action by the international community. So thus, it doesn't seem, according to many analysts, and even if you ask people on the streets here, that any kind of a credible investigation will happen, especially at this time where it's very difficult to collect any kind of evidence in that area due to the presence of terrorist groups like Daesh.
All right, thanks a lot. Mohammed Ali, our correspondent, joining us from the Syrian capital, Damascus, and Mr. Tim Anderson joining us from Sydney. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. The North Korean leader criticizes the officials' handling of the country's outbreak of the coronavirus. Speaking at a party meeting, Kim Jong-un said immaturity in the state's capacity to respond to the outbreak has exacerbated the crisis. North Korea has reported over 1.7 million cases with fever symptoms, as well as more than 60 deaths. While North Korea reported its first COVID-19 infection last week, it is yet to reveal how many people have tested positive for the coronavirus. The country's leader has already branded the outbreak the biggest turmoil the republic has experienced since its foundation. Activists in Latin American countries hold events to mark the 74th anniversary of Palestine's Nakba Day, or the Day of Catastrophe. People in Peru, Panama, Chile, and Argentina held rallies and marches in solidarity with the people of Palestine. The Venezuelan capital, Caracas, paid tribute to slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by projecting her photo on a building of the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development. The Al Jazeera reporter was fatally shot by Israeli troops last week while covering a raid on the Palestinian city of Jenin. Abu Akleh's death touched off international condemnation of the Tel Aviv regime's violence. And the Palestinian embassy in Rome has opened a condolence book in remembrance of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin last Wednesday. Several members of the Italian parliament signed the book and discussed a plan of action to set up an international investigation committee over her killing. Max Giuli has more from the Italian capital.
A condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh, omitting Israel's responsibility.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shirin is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Virus has laid bare America's fragmented healthcare system and corrosive racial and socioeconomic inequality. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Glenza, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. COVID deaths hit 1 million, a death toll higher than any other country. Stay tuned for more. More than 1 million people have died in the COVID-19 pandemic in the U.S., according to Johns Hopkins, far and away the most deaths of any country. While the sheer number of deaths from the coronavirus sets the U.S. apart, the country's large population of 332.5 million people does not explain the staggering mortality rate, which is among the highest in the world. For every 100,000 residents, 291 people have died from COVID-19, according to the Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. Among the 20 worst-affected nations, only two other countries, including Brazil and Poland, have higher mortality rates per 100,000 people. Deaths directly attributable to COVID-19 are only one measure of the pandemic's toll. Deaths from drug overdoses hit a record high in 2021, killing at least 100,000 Americans. Chronic conditions such as heart disease, hypertension, and dementia have contributed to the number of excess deaths, a number which includes other ailments exacerbated by the pandemic, as well as those deaths caused directly by COVID-19. This number crossed the 1 million threshold in mid-February. The extraordinary toll has set the U.S. apart among wealthy peer nations, exposing inequality, a unique and fragmented health system, and polarized politics, all of which likely made the crisis worse, researchers said. In terms of understanding why we had such a bad experience from the pandemic, we have to think about the systematic issues that already were in place when the pandemic arrived, said Stephen Wolf, a social epidemiologist and population health researcher at Virginia Commonwealth University, adding, "And on top of that, mishandling of the pandemic by the U.S. government and by the public, frankly. The pandemic shone a light on longstanding racial and ethnic health disparities as Black, Latino, and Native American people were infected, hospitalized, and died of COVID-19 at rates that were, at times, double those of white Americans." The drivers of those outcomes, the disproportionate likelihood for people of color to lack the same quality housing, employment, and healthcare access as white Americans, are well known and documented. Such disparities are the intended or unintended consequences of policy decisions, a recent commentary in the Journal of the American Medical Association said. The U.S. has nonetheless had difficulty correcting course. Vaccines were at first slow to reach minority, low-income, and rural areas. One recent study has shown how at least one advanced COVID-19 therapy, monoclonal antibodies, were the least likely to reach the highest-risk patients for whom they were recommended. It just exacerbated the struggles we currently have and pulled back the curtain on all the issues we've been dealing with for so many years, said Terrence Shirley, CEO of the Community Health Center Association of Mississippi. Community health centers help treat indigent and marginalized Americans who cannot pay for health care. The all-consuming nature of the pandemic has also allowed preventable and treatable infectious diseases to flourish. Thousands of young children, particularly in low-income households, have fallen behind on routine vaccinations. Rates of sexually transmitted diseases have reached the highest numbers in American history, as overwhelmed and underfunded local health agencies reallocated resources to COVID-19. Meanwhile, the mental health of adolescents in particular has suffered as millions were cut off from the mental health services provided by schools. Pediatricians, children's hospitals, and psychiatrists declared a mental health crisis among the nation's youth, and a recent CDC study has shown how emergency room visits for eating disorders has increased dramatically among adolescents, girls. Millions of children were also thrust into food insecurity as the numbers of children receiving school meals plummeted. Missed academic time appears to have caused the educational and achievement gap to widen. The U.S. has been experiencing worse health outcomes for some years now. Life expectancy in the U.S. is the lowest of any high-income country, said Wolf, adding, "There is a set of reasons for it, but all of those rolled right into the pandemic." However, America's reliance on an expensive private and exclusionary healthcare system is not solely to blame. Although policies that exclude 28 million uninsured individuals from healthcare have likely made things worse, they're only one example of how fragmented policy has worsened Americans' health. Concepts fundamental to U.S. governance also proved problematic in the pandemic. In just one example, the U.S. Constitution makes public health the responsibility of individual states, creating a patchwork of different pandemic responses. Culture and environment also appear played a role. Americans are more likely than citizens of other countries to engage in what public health researchers consider risky behavior, such as gun ownership, smoking, consuming more calories, and exercising less. Polarized politics make it more difficult to implement guardrails on these behaviors. Floundering responses by federal, state, and local governments compounded existing issues and eventually allowed pandemic-related public health guidance to become political and cultural footballs. Less than 2/3 of Republicans have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, compared with 91% of Democrats, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation's January 2022 vaccine tracking poll. The only thing both parties appear to agree on, according to the same poll, is how the pandemic has exhausted them. That has led to another riddle. As more and more pandemic prevention measures are dropped, Americans will be faced with how to live with a disease that can be chronic and disabling, even if it isn't as deadly. Death is not the only serious outcome from COVID, said David Potrino, the director of Rehabilitation Innovation for Mount Sinai Health System. Potrino has seen thousands of cases of so-called long COVID, where many varied and at times severe symptoms persist for months. A recent analysis by the Center for American Progress found the syndrome resulted in an estimated 1.2 million more disabled people in 2021. Shirley said, "We are addressing the acute illness and not resolving the issues that could prevent the illness in the first place."
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The surge in the cost of living in the UK is taking a heavy toll on the people's health. According to a YouGov poll, 55% of Britons complain about the worsening health due to such factors as heating and food costs. Retailers have also warned that food price inflation could hit 10% in Britain this year. The Bank of England governor has admitted he is unable to stop inflation hitting 10%.
The UK government's latest data shows the unemployment rate has fallen to a new five-decade low, with the value of wages going down amid rising inflation. The governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, says the two main drivers of inflation are energy and global goods prices resulting from the Ukraine war. He has warned that the fallout from surging prices will cause unemployment to increase. He described the situation surrounding soaring food costs as apocalyptic.
I'm afraid the one that I am going to sound, I guess, rather apocalyptic about is food. I think two things that the Ukrainian finance minister said. One is Ukraine does have food in store, but it can't get it out at the moment. Two, while he was optimistic about crop planting, he was pretty optimistic about planting, interestingly, but he said at the moment, you know, we have no way of shipping it out.
Bailey also warned of a very real income shock. While average wages are rising in the UK, the government says they continue to sink in real terms as Britain, like others, faces runaway inflation. The Bank of England also warned that Brexit has made the bad situation worse, saying that leaving the EU will continue to have a negative effect on the economy. Consumer price inflation was at 7% last month, the highest in 30 years, while the energy price cap rose by 54%. The Bank of England expects further price rise will push the economy close to recession by the end of 2022. It says the inflation may top 10% by December. A British think tank, Resolution Foundation, has warned that UK households are facing a cost of living catastrophe. A survey conducted by Ipsos also shows that one in three Brits say they have missed meals recently because of surging inflation. According to the poll, two in three people in the country are turning off their heating system. The surge has also taken a heavy toll on the health sector, with 55% of Britons surveyed saying their health has worsened due to the skyrocketing cost of living. Chancellor of Exchequer Rishi Sunak has raised pressure to do more now to address the crisis facing many households. The Bank of England has already raised its interest rate to tackle the prices. Its key rate now stands at the highest level since the global financial crisis in 2009. But analysts say that's too little, too late.
So the Bank of England missed the opportunity to avoid all this some time ago. All right, it should have been raising interest rates substantially some time ago. All right, and it's too little too late. And in fact, this 1% is not going to make any difference. All right, interest rates at 1% with inflation headed to 10, as I say, in economics, we call it a negative real return of 9%. All right, so in fact, you've got savers are getting killed, all right, because they're earning 1%, but the cost of living is going up 10.
Millions in Britain now face one big question: how to make ends meet, as many believe the crisis has barely begun and the situation will get much worse in the coming weeks and months.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and as you've noticed, we're going to discuss British economic woes. Let me introduce our guests in this episode. Journalist, author and activist Fra Hughes is joining us out of Belfast. With us, we'll also have historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling in Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now, Fra, let me start asking you this question. The BOE governor mentioned that rising prices for energy and goods as cause of inflation. He stressed the shocks such as the Russian invasion of Ukraine and also the impact of China's zero COVID policy. Now, what factors do you blame for the situation in the UK?
Well, I believe that what we're maybe witnessing now is also part of the capitalist global kind of boom bust that comes along every 10 years. I mean, it was 2007 since the last real recession came in because of the kind of financial irregularities around the subprime housing market in America and stuff. In Britain at the minute, housing is probably higher than it was before the previous financial collapse. So I think it's worth maybe repeating that, you know, with the Bank of England interest rates only at 1%, it still means that people can borrow money at very low rates. And as people begin to struggle to pay their bills and to meet their commitments, and the rent sector is beginning to go through the roof. So we've got, you know, high house prices, very high rent, stagnant wages, inflation going up. Money is still relatively easy to get on credit, which in itself could become a long-term time bomb for the people who find themselves in difficulty. But it's a neoliberal austerity that's been followed by the Conservative Party, perhaps, and the Labour Party, actually from Margaret Thatcher for nearly 40 years, that have led to the demise of public services, the health service, education. I think it's almost like a perfect storm that with inflation going up and alongside the kind of extraordinary rise in energy prices and the government refusing to bring in a windfall tax on the money that's being made by the energy utilities in order to defer the price raises for the average consumer and the families in Britain. I think, to paraphrase what the governor of the Bank of England said, is apocalyptic. We have more food banks than we've ever had. We have more homeless people than we've ever had. And if employment does rise, then you will find more people in difficulty with their mortgages. You will find more house repossessions. You will find more families breaking up due to the financial strain. You'll have more children hungry going to school. It's a nightmare in the making, and a lot of it could be pointed at America's coup in Ukraine in 2014. And when America can afford to give $44 billion in weapons, lethal aid to the Ukraine, what does that say about the people who are suffering under the economic sanctions that are rebounding in Western Europe and America due to their short-sighted political falling and falling out with Russia? That is causing all these problems for their own citizens.
Okay. Well, yes, Fra, as you just mentioned, there are many, many factors involved. We'll discuss some of them in more details later on in the show. Now, Tony, the Bank of England also saying that the Brexit has made a bad situation worse. So what do you think about the impact of this Brexit and divorce deal on the British economy?
Isn't it interesting? Because the previous governor of the Bank of England said he thought Brexit was going to make almost no difference whatsoever to the British economy, because things would still be being traded across the Channel, and that it is the much bigger factors that will make things. For example, these massive sanctions on Russia, because the way this is being framed is that it's the Ukrainian war that's caused this. No, It's the reaction to the Ukrainian war by the West, but Britain particularly has spearheaded this reaction. That is to say, boycotting all these necessities that Britain and the rest of the West need from Russia. So in a way, they've brought this situation upon themselves by overreacting. But I also want to say, this isn't just a one-off, it's not an accident. This is something that's been being framed for years. And if you look just, you know, back 6 months or so, we saw two things happening. One was a big warning back in August, September, here in 2021 in the UK, that there was going to be a massive hike in fuel prices. Well, no explanation was given for that, but we now know what's happened. We also had all the troops brought back from Afghanistan. Nobody was really told why that was, but now we know. And that is because the West was preparing the provocation of the invasion of the Donbass in Ukraine right the way back at the autumn of last year. And they knew that the Russians would have to react as NATO and the Ukrainian army prepared to invade the Donbass in Ukraine. And so I think they knew that all this was going to happen and it's been prepared. So the main, I also agree with Finian very much that rent plays a very important part. We keep hearing about the increase in fuel prices, the energy prices going up 50%. It's roughly 25% for the petrol and diesel prices. But actually, rent is the killer. And rent is so ridiculously high in Britain. It's the average, right? And that is including the people who own their own homes, is one third of people's income they're having to spend on their rent. So they've got very little. And that is mortgage repayments too. Mm-hmm. So they've got very little. Most of the population have got very little. Many have got nothing left after they've finished paying their rent. So the idea that these other things like energy and fuel are going up has basically tipped them underneath, basically put them into the red. You know, so they are now unable, through going to work, to pay enough money to live. Mm-hmm. And this is a deadly serious situation. And, of course, it means that they won't be paying tax. Therefore, the government is going to have less tax revenue and the government's going to go further into the black. Yeah. But we've just had this week an announcement from Jacob Rees-Mogg, the Conservative MP, chairman of the Privy Council, and he was the leader of the House as well, Conservative, of course, that we're going to be sacking 90,000 civil servants. So that's taking a fantastic amount out of the economy again. That money that those civil servants would have been paid, would have been spending. And so there, it seems to me as if they're deliberately, basically committing harakiri, suiciding the economy. Alex Craner, the analyst, he's a former hedge fund manager, was saying it's like a suicide pact. And the catalyst for all of this over the last few months has been the deliberate imposition of massive sanctions on Russia, even though, of course, Ukraine is not a NATO country. And, you know, that, I think, is basically what's going on. And Britain is the fifth richest country in the world, according to most of the metrics. And so what, if you look at it, if you take a step back at this and look, right, what you'll see is that the what's happening is the wealth is being hoarded by the wealthy. They're using their lobbying power and wealth in order to impoverish the rest of the nation. So it's setting the rich against the poor, and the divide is getting bigger and bigger by the minute.
Yeah. Now, Fry, there are some people who argue that the worst is yet to come for Britain, you know, citing the post-Brexit tensions that are growing wider with the EU over the Northern Ireland Agreement. You know, the administration talked about making some changes to the protocol, and the EU is warning against it, and also warning of harsh repercussions for that.
Yes, well, we've had, I live in Belfast, so we've had Boris Johnson visiting yesterday. It's interesting that he chose to visit the Thales armament factory in East Belfast. They make component parts for the Javelin missiles, I think they're anti-tank missiles. So he was over cheering on the boys and girls making the bombs and the missiles that are going to be used on Russian soldiers and the people defending the Donbass against the fascist incursions from Kiev. But I think what we have here and what we're witnessing is this, in many respects, is just normal politics. This is Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and it's also Geoffrey Donaldson of the Democratic Unionist Party here in the north of Ireland. They are just playing a game of chicken and brinkmanship, and this is very well Boris Johnson, because they're destabilised peace process here, and that is caused by the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, that will have to change. But what we're talking about is a small rump of loyalist, extremist, reactionary paramilitaries who would rather die than see there be some form of a second-class citizenship for them within the United Kingdom. And we have Geoffrey Donaldson and the DUP refusing to go into government with Sinn Féin and the other parties until the protocol is scrapped. So Boris Johnson and Liz Truss several weeks ago said they were going to rip up the Northern Ireland Protocol, that they were going to bring in legislation that would supersede that international agreement. Now they're saying that they want to continue talks with the EU to settle the outstanding issues, and that basically their legislation would be an insurance policy. But it's really a threat to the EU. Do what we want or we will act unilaterally. I don't believe for a second Boris Johnson and the United Kingdom Parliament and Cabinet will do that. And I feel that Boris Johnson, along with the choreography that's taking place here, are just trying to use the leverage of the threat of violence here in the north of Ireland to force the EU's hand. And I think they're following along suggestions from the DUP that we don't need to have border checks on the island of Ireland. We don't need to have a hard border within Ireland, that there can be some form of electronic monitoring of vehicles and goods travelling from the north of Ireland to the south of Ireland. But I don't believe that the British government fully intends to change the Northern Ireland Protocol. It's just politics and bluff and bluster.
Okay. Now, Tony, Bank of England was also blaming this Russia-Ukraine war for some of the woes in the British economy. But the UK was already facing energy price hikes even before the Russian military operation began in Ukraine, if you remember. So what was responsible for that issue? And then how did it spiral into this situation we're facing now?
Well, I mean, we didn't really have much in the way of price hikes in terms of energy. It was just that there were, and there was, it was announced that the United States would be supplying more of our energy and the Russians would be supplying less. That was announced last year. So goodness knows why. I think they want to kind of put, for the Americans, they want to put sanctions on Russia. But I have to disagree about the protocol, the Northern Ireland Protocol. I think this is going to go. At the moment, there's a sizable, it's difficult to know whether it's a majority or minority. And it doesn't, and it includes some people from both of the different sides of the divide. That is to say, the nationalist community in Northern Ireland who want to generally want to stay with Ireland. They were going to send migrants who came across the English Channel from France over to Rwanda. It basically hasn't happened. It's an empty announcement. And this really does explain how I think it illustrates how little power the British government really has and how little handle Boris Johnson has on the nation. I don't think he has. People who are really running things over here are the big corporations, the oil companies that put a fuel crisis on at the time of the party political broadcasts last year, the party conferences, sorry. We had these fuel price hikes almost to send a message to the political parties about who's really in charge. And when you've got weak government, it's the banks, the banksters, the City of London and the big corporations who are really in charge. At the end of the day, though, we've got 500,000 children now in absolute poverty. That means that the parents have to start claiming benefits, food banks, things like this in order to feed their children. And this is, as I say, the fifth richest country in the world. So it's clear what's going on. The rich are just starving the poor. And we've got, as a so-called answer to all of this here in Bristol, I was very amused the other day to see they're putting up signs in Southmead, which is one of the poorest districts in the city, with smiling faces on, saying, be happy, this is our happy city. In fact, there's even an organisation which is putting these happy city messages out. And, of course, this is what the government, in its very patronising manner, has been funding, and our local government here in Bristol, in order to sort of tell people, it's OK, it doesn't matter if you're in poverty and you've got no prospects for your children's future, you can just smile and be happy. So it's horrifically horrifically patronising. So I think the main culprits behind all this, of course, are the City of London. They are running the country for their own private profit and as a investment place, and they've really lost sight of the needs and the interests of the population.
Okay. Now, we have 1 or 2 minutes left. There is this YouGov poll indicating the cost of living taking a heavy toll on people's health. 55% of Britons say their health has worsened due to heating and food costs. So what measures has Downing Street taken to address those issues?
Well, I don't think it's taken any. As I mentioned earlier on, there's no windfall tax, which you would think would be the first thing a government that's concerned about its citizens would bring in. I mean, huge, huge, almost immoral, obscene profits are being made by these utility companies, and nothing is being given back to the people. I can imagine, I mean, even long before this in Britain, every winter, there were thousands of senior citizens who are maybe on a basic state pension, who had to decide between heating their homes and in eating their dinner. And people would die each year. People were found in their homes with the heating turned off because they'd either run out of money or couldn't afford it. And they were just sitting in their front rooms or lying in bed with extra blankets and extra coats to try and keep them warm. I can understand how people's health is beginning to suffer because if you're under stress, financial strain, you're worried about how you're going to put food on the table for your children, how you're going to clothe your kids, how you're going to sort out their extra curricular school activities. I mean, stress is probably one of the biggest inducers of strokes, heart attacks and suicides in Western Europe in first world countries. So I think that this huge burden that the government is placing onto the shoulders of its citizens is going to have a devastating...
Okay, we're running out of time. Tony, only 30 seconds. Sorry, Fravo, jumping in. 30 seconds.
Use the word apocalyptic to describe the food shortages potentially in the future. Now, this is a very important word. He's not used this word accidentally. This is a biblical reference to the book of Revelation, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And what worries me is that actually the third horse, the black horse, if you go down to the Bible and have a look, talks about food shortages. It talks about massive rising prices for basic foods, and it talks about famine. So I think we should take his warning seriously. What he's basically, I think, signalling is that he doesn't have any ability to control the situation now, and it may well be running out of control. And we may be looking at literally the sorts of signs that are written about in the New Testament about the horrific kind of situation that could bring about a kind of crisis in the whole of civilization.
Sorry for jumping.
So
that's
interesting word to
have,
use, isn't it? Apocalyptic.
I'm sorry for interrupting. That's all the time we have. Journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes joined me from Belfast. Historian, investigative journalist Tony Gosling from Bristol with their insight.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
A person who gets the permission can benefit more from his presence in a holy site.